Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
Hello and welcome to the Transfer Window, the podcast that has consistently brought you the news before it becomes news during the window, which has just closed, as well as information analysis on all the subjects you're talking about in football. I've been McGarry, and with me, I'm glad to say, as always, is Duncan Castle. Beware of cheap imitations, as we like to say on the podcast. And it has been a very, very busy window, which has just, as the great Kaiser Duck would say, slammed shut after a hectic 3 months of wheeling and dealing. While lots of money was spent, certainly in the English Premier League, in bringing players in and also exporting players out, potentially the largest and most high-profile transfer of the window would have been Kylian Mbappe had his deal from Paris Saint-Germain to Real Madrid gone through. However, PSG, as predicted by Duncan on the pod, do not want to lose face by selling their best player. The Qatari state nation owners decided they would turn down a bid of almost 200 million euros for the France international on the last day of the window. Duncan, I often say this, but I must admit, I'll never get tired of saying it either. You've got 3 months to do a deal like this, and yet you wait to the last day before you actually put in the bid that you think is going to get you the player. You have the timeline of what happened with regards to Madrid's interest. Why don't you explicate that for us? Because it's really very intriguing with regards to how things developed over the last 4 or 5 days.
Well, to be fair to Real Madrid, they didn't leave it to the last day, and they didn't want it to go to the last day. As we explained on last week's podcast, they made their first offer with just over a week left in the window. They made it a very high offer. As we said, it was designed to be a mark of respect towards Paris Saint-Germain, who they recognise as one of the powers in European football at present, and I think who they recognise as important to their Super League project that Florentino Perez still wants to happen, and which PSG were very pivotal in blocking, basically creating an alliance with UEFA president Alexander Čeferin, which has benefited them greatly subsequently. One of the interesting parts in what happened between the two clubs is that Madrid ended up making three offers, formal offers to PSG for Kylian Mbappe, the last of those on deadline day for 200 million euros. And what I am told from the Madrid end, from people involved in negotiating the deal, is that Paris Saint-Germain simply refused to respond to them. They did not reply to the second last offer. They did not reply to the 200 million euro offer. They just left Real Madrid to come to the conclusion that the deal was not going to happen and that they needed to sign Eduardo Camavinga, midfielder, young French midfielder, in order to present a player as an acquisition in this window. It leaves them in a position which some people argued that they were trying to achieve in the first place, in the way that they bid for the player, which was to be seen to have made a huge offer. This would have represented the second highest transfer fee ever paid for a player after PSG's acquisition of Neymar. Allowed them to place a value on Mbappe and allowed them to increase his status, knowing that they could pick the player up in January on a pre-contract agreement for no transfer fee, being able to put him in their team for the following 2022-23 season. Now, guidance I have from the people involved in this is that was not the case, that Florentino Perez wanted this to happen, and he wanted the player in place immediately we've told you all along that he'd been saving all of the transfer resources for a couple of seasons now for Real Madrid to put into this deal. So he had the money to pay that fee. Interesting thing is how it's been perceived by Kylian Mbappe, and the guidance I have is he is unhappy with the situation. He's unhappy that his attempts to explain to Qatar that he was no longer happy at PSG and that he decided he wanted to move to Real Madrid, talking about the gentleman's agreement that we reported a couple of weeks ago, that he had with PSG when he signed for the club, that he would spend 4 years there and then be transferred for a large sum ahead of the final year of his contract, Qatar breaking that agreement in his view. He told Leonardo, who the sports director, who the relationship with is not great, that he wanted out. He told Nasser Al-Khelaifi, the club president, that he wanted out. He told Mauricio Pochettino that he wanted out. He told the Emir of Qatar that he wanted out, and still they would not allow him to go. I'm told he's now concerned that he needs to focus on how he performs for the team, because PSG want to give him a new contract. They're pushing him to sign a new contract. He obviously doesn't expect that to go away. There is a concern, I'm told, on his side that if he does not perform well, they will use as part of leverage leaving him out of the team or making him less important to the way the team plays. Obviously, that could be an issue to him if he does sign that pre-contract in January, because at that point, they will know they're losing him in 6 months' time. Therefore, there'll be more of an incentive to leave him out of the side. He wants to play football, particularly in the build-up to a World Cup year. He wants the best conditions to play football. That's one of the reasons he's decided to move to Real Madrid. And he's concerned that now being stuck at PSG for another season, he doesn't have the best conditions to play, and he's in a difficult position because they will use whatever tools they can to try and persuade him to sign a new contract there. The Qatari side, we talked about the Emir of Qatar's brother going on social media to comment in various different ways about the progress of this deal, some of them quite contradictory. But at the end of the process, Khalifa Al Thani retweeted a Spanish language football commentator saying, "It was time for us to learn that money matters little to them. What they want is to be the season's best team, even if it costs them the free transfer of Mbappe." So basically, they want that year of having the lineup with the attack of Mbappe, Neymar, Messi all together, plus the other players they've put in alongside them, a huge number of high-cost salary acquisitions. They even responded on deadline day by taking Nuno Mendes, young Portuguese left-back on loan from Sporting, with a 40 million option to buy, player that Chiqui Berguiristan would like to have taken to Manchester City at some point, so he strengthened even further. Al Thani commenting on that said, "This everyone knows, so it was better not to bother," on Real Madrid's part. It leaves, I think, that this experiment that PSG have built even more fascinating, because we talked about how difficult it's going to be to combine so many superstar players in one team, whether there was enough running involved in the team. Now you have this Kylian Mbappe's discontent to deal with, and this story which will rumble on, although Qatar have managed to hold the player through this window. The issue has not gone away. And I think the sort of general discussion of where football is when clubs like PSG can afford to turn down the second highest transfer fee offer of all time for a player who they have been told will leave for nothing in a year's time. We saw Javier Tebas, the president of La Liga, commenting after it became clear the deal wasn't going to go through. And he said, again on social media, "Nation states clubs are as dangerous to the football ecosystem as the Super League. We were critical of the Super League because it destroys European football, and we are equally critical of PSG. COVID losses of over 300 million euros, TV revenue in France down 40%, and over 500 million euros in salaries. Unsustainable," was his comment on this.
Well, Duncan, speaking to a source, a very senior source at Real Madrid in the last 24 hours, I was told that, yes, what you've reported with regards to Florentino determined to make this happen in this window and have Mbappe in his team and not challenge for the La Liga title and the Champions League is correct. However, Mbappe and his representatives have been told that since the bid failed, that the fee that was offered of 200 million euros will be converted into his salary package on offer when he joins them on a free transfer, along with the money they put aside for his salary anyway in the first instance, which of course will then make him most probably the highest paid football player in the world when he does join Real Madrid. But one of the reasons Madrid were determined to get it done as well was because they knew that Mbappe, if he's available for free, could become the subject of an auction to other major and elite football clubs, and who could rival Real Madrid in terms of wages. And so Madrid instead have gone all out and said, look, the 200 million euros that we are willing to pay for you will be converted into that in your wages when you join us, plus the commission for the deal, as well as bonuses, etc. So that they hope will be enough to persuade him to sign the pre-contract in January, or indeed sign a heads of agreement, which is not illegal. It's simply a legal letter saying that Kylian Mbappe and Real Madrid have come to an agreement that he would join them in the summer of 2022. So it all looks done and dusted. I think it's interesting what you say about Mbappe perhaps being demotivated for the season ahead, or indeed PSG being demotivated about playing him in such a star-studded squad. But I'm also reminded of a story, Duncan, when you said about not being a lot of tracking back happening when that front three of Messi, Neymar and Mbappe for the season ahead of when Andy Cole and Teddy Sheringham had a massive fallout at Manchester United because Cole had not tracked back for a corner, i.e. to defend a corner against Man United, in which they conceded a goal. And when Sheringham confronted him, he said, "Andy Cole, don't make tea." And the two never spoke a word to each other afterwards. I'm pretty sure Kylian Mbappe don't make tea either. So that will be a very interesting dynamic to watch in Ligue 1 and, of course, the Champions League this season. The most high-profile transfer not being Kylian Mbappe, it actually was Cristiano Ronaldo to Manchester United, who, of course, we reported that to you last week. And you have some interesting information regarding the, I'm not going to say sacrifice, because that will sound a little bit disrespectful to people who earn the minimum wage, but the sacrifice that Cristiano Ronaldo has made in order to rejoin Manchester United in terms of his salary. And of course, he signed a two-year deal with a one-year option.
Yeah, look, he took a pay cut on his 31 million euro net salary at Juventus to come to Manchester United, which fits with, I think, how the deal came around. This is something we've been reporting on for many months. I think back in March, we talked about how Cristiano Ronaldo's representative, Jesse Foote, had put an idea out to the Glazers, which was, you have just won the Super Bowl, hiring a veteran superstar quarterback, Tom Brady. He's turned around years of disappointment for the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, and made the difference. You have the option this summer, if you want to do it, to hire the greatest sportsman of all time, as he considers himself, Cristiano Ronaldo. He will be available. If you want to put him into the side you're developing, this is your opportunity to win the Premier League again and to be competitive in the Champions League again. He wants to win more Champions League titles. There is an issue at Juventus. Juventus are not competitive. Juventus, because of the impact of COVID upon them, are open to letting Ronaldo leave at the end of the season. Do you want to go ahead and do it? So that's been sitting there for months at Manchester United. And my information was United's response was, we're interested. We are looking for a forward. You're on the list, but no actual approach to make the deal happen until those very final days of the window. And as we discussed the detail and on last Friday's podcast, it went from a situation where Cristiano Ronaldo had agreed verbally to join Manchester City. He'd been told that a deal could be done to go there if he was prepared to move there. He had conversations with Pep Guardiola. He liked what he heard from Guardiola. Obviously, he saw Manchester City, their need for a striker, given that Harry Kane deal had fallen through, and their strengths as a team, the dominant force in English football, plus having just reached a Champions League final and the entire focus of Abu Dhabi on getting that first European Cup to the club. He saw it as a place where he could go and win again and be competitive at the very top and embellish his record. That, as you detailed, Ian, came with a response from Manchester United. They basically woke up and realised that if they didn't do something, Cristiano Ronaldo, their most famous player of the modern era, was going to join the rivals and potentially turn them into Champions League winners. There had been conversations and Cristiano Ronaldo has referred to those in his first interview for Manchester United between him and Sir Alex Ferguson. I'm told that he had a discussion with Ferguson where he said he explained that he wasn't happy at Juventus and asked him for his advice, and the guidance he got was come home. But it took that situation where he was about to join Manchester City for it actually to be put into effect. Number of Manchester United players, former teammates, calling Ronaldo to say, how can you go there? If you're coming back to England, come back to United. Ferguson also trying to persuade him to do that. On the Thursday, a call came from Ferguson saying United were ready to make an offer. And very rapidly, that deal was put in place. An interesting transfer fee of 15 million euros agreed with Juventus, but paid over 5 years on a contract that is 2 years plus an option of one, with a further 8 million of performance-related variables. So done in a way that there's minimal immediate transfer fee cost to United, but obviously a huge addition to their salary bill. And you have Ronaldo kind of underlining all of this in his first Instagram message saying, I'm right here. I'm back where I belong. Let's make it happen once again. P.S. Sir Alex, this one is for you. And then in an interview with the club website saying he had a big role, talking about Ferguson, because the relationship that we had, we keep in touch all the time. And he's an unbelievable person. I really like him a lot. And he was the main key for me to be in the position that I am, that I signed for Manchester United. And Ian, you're someone who's covered Sir Alex Ferguson's career in football to a great degree and has good contacts with people close to him. What do you think the importance of this return of his favourite player? I think it's fair to say that someone who describes Ferguson as his father in football means for the organisation of the club and Ferguson's role and influence at the club going forward.
Frankly, he will now have one of the most important players who is, as Cristiano says, his sporting father in the dressing room, someone who he's in touch with very frequently, and who asks his advice, who acts on his advice, who will carry out advice that he gives as well. And that is something which, of course, the Glazers have been striving to denigrate since he retired as manager of the club. So this changes the whole dynamic, I believe, at Manchester United in terms of Ferguson's influence. I think the Glazers have tolerated, maybe too strong a word, but it's not far off Ferguson's continued presence. You see him sitting in the director's box at Southampton, and of course he has privileges with regards to his presence, etc., and his presence in the boardroom as well. However, he has not been part of decision-making processes per se for much of the time since he left his position as the club's manager.
And yeah, we should emphasise here, although he's a director of a club, he is on the broader board that is the non-executive decision-making
exactly,
board.
Exactly, yes. Yeah, he is. And this will give him direct access to what's going on in the dressing room, because Ferguson, his players, if you like, don't exist anymore in the dressing room. So he can't rely on information coming out of the dressing room directly as being part of his information hotline.
He still has Phil Jones there, so he must have good information on the medical department.
Yeah, so this is going to be very interesting, I think, because as I said, the Glazers basically... the foundation of their decision to move Ferguson out was that they thought he had too much power, and therefore they wanted to increase their own influence with regards to the football department. And that is now going to shift. There's going to be a difference in the dynamic, and Ferguson will now have a direct influence on what goes on in the dressing room, how it is run, and how the team itself behaves. Okay, Solskjaer has been very clever, I think, in distancing himself on several occasions from Ferguson, because at the beginning of his time, when he was appointed as the interim manager, he referenced Ferguson a lot, and that definitely annoyed the Glazers and Ed Woodward with regards to the fact that they wanted to move away from the Ferguson era. And as a result, Solskjaer stopped doing that. He was told, don't do that. And he stopped doing that because he wanted to keep his job. But now you've got, as I said, the most important and most and the highest paid player at the club, who is extremely close to Ferguson. Now, this is a team, obviously, who are failing to win trophies, who are struggling with regards to being competitive in a meaningful way. And all of a sudden, the gaffer's back. And that is going to be a very, very interesting situation to watch developing throughout the course of this season, because it's something which may work, because Ferguson clearly is a proven winner. But at the same time, it could also provide a huge source of friction between the owners of the club and the football department that they have been trying to take control of, or have taken control of, for the past 7 years. So, yes, it will be, let's just say, it'll be a sub-story, obviously, because the main story will be on the pitch, but it'll be a very interesting sub-story. And
I think there's that dynamic, and there's also the dynamic of what it does to the team, because, look, they're adding the most prodigious goal scorer in European football over more than a decade. I think there's a nice statistic comparing Cristiano Ronaldo's goal return since he left Manchester United to the goal return of Manchester United's leading scorer in all of the season since he left. And it is miles ahead of the cumulative total, and ahead and I think every season but one. I think he equaled the leading scorer in his first season away from the club. So he is the reigning leading scorer in Italy during his time in La Liga, 311 La Liga goals in 292 games. There's no question that they have added one of the top finishers in football to their attack. And also, as Solskjaer and many others have stated, an example and a leader in the dressing room who should have make a fundamental difference to the way the players he plays alongside behave and think about the game. He is ultimately and totally focused on winning. And I think that's something that's going to be very important to Manchester United. There have been periods over the last 4 or 5 seasons where you see players who seem to have lost the Manchester United attitude of nothing less than victory is acceptable. And it will not be acceptable to Cristiano Ronaldo, and he will push that team. But if you were going to do this deal, and as we've explained, the deal has been available to them for months. This could have been strategically done. It could have been set up in advance. He could have been in early, as they have very successfully done with Rafael Varane and Jadon Sancho, unusually for United doing those deals quickly and efficiently. If you were going to do it, you could have done it in a way where the dynamic of the squad and the structure of the squad was much better balanced. You would not have had Anthony Martial remaining there or Edson Cavani remaining there. One or the other would have been allowed to leave. Cavani, you probably wouldn't have renewed his contract. They had put Martial on the market. He'd been offered around European football from the beginning of the window, and no one was prepared to take him because his salary is one of the highest in the Premier League, and he hadn't had the greatest of seasons for United. What they've created as a squad where they're really, although people are still trying to make excuses for Solskjaer and saying he should add a defensive midfielder that basically needs a perfect answer in every single position of the field. But the squad is now one where realistically you have to say, if this can't win silverware, then the problem is with the coach. They have 27 full internationals in that first team squad. Registered at the club and at the club at present. They have in attack, they have 7 full internationals plus Jesse Lingard, who they've hung on to despite other clubs wanting to sign him because they wanted a £25 million fee for him. The only player they've let go of is Daniel James. I think they did quite well to get £25 million from Leeds United for at the end of the window. But you have, where does Ronaldo play? Does he play as number 9? Or does he play off the left wing, which is Marcus Rashford's preferred position? How much game time does Martial get? What does Mason Greenwood do if Jadon Sancho is going to be playing right wing? If you set up with Ronaldo on the left, and for all his scoring in Italy, there is a statistic that he was the least effective presser in the Juventus team last season. You would then have Cristiano Ronaldo left wing, Luke Shaw left back, not a man who's renowned for his positional skill and sometimes for his effort at getting back into position. If you watch goals United conceded last season, there's a lot of them where Shaw has just failed to track players back. And Harry Maguire playing on the left side of the central defence. I don't think it will be too complex for opposition technical staff to decide which flank they're going to attack if that sets up as the standard formation for United this season. It could have been done earlier. It could have been done in a more structured way, but they've given themselves the opportunity to do something that you wouldn't have imagined Manchester United doing a year and a half, 2 years ago. It's not the way the Glazers have gone. And they've put, I think, Solskjaer in a position where there can't be any more excuses. He will have to deliver this season, or There are not going to be many people, perhaps Gary Neville will say it's about the defensive midfield. There are not going to be many people saying, actually, the Glazers haven't provided him with what he needed. Let's go into the market again and spend another 100 million plus on finally getting it to the stage where United can win silverware again.
What they've done, Duncan, which I find, you know, significant with regards to this particular signing, is they've signed a genuine superstar footballer, which is something United have lacked in recent years, something that they were synonymous with. You think about the players that they have had in their ranks over the last 20 years, 30 years even, has always been a superstar player who provides an aura and who obviously gets the crowd excited when they play because of the way that they play, because they play with freedom, because they play with flair. And United have not had that. They had become quite stale, I think, in terms of the way in which they conducted themselves. And even at 36, Cristiano Ronaldo is that kind of player who brings the, as I said, the aura to the dressing room. So when the younger players go into the dressing room and they see Ronaldo there, they'll think, oh my God, I'm getting to play alongside Cristiano Ronaldo. And that's not to be underestimated. And a club like Manchester United have required that for quite some time, but they haven't had it. And so I think that in itself is significant with regards to how they might perform this season. No one can predict, obviously, if they're going to start winning silverware just because of Ronaldo's arrival. But the fact of the matter is, they've probably done the right thing in bringing him to the club or back to the club, even at his age, because as we know, he may be 36, but he plays like someone who's 27, 28 because of his fitness levels and his attitude towards his physicality and his mentality as well. So that will be, I believe, something which will benefit Manchester United. And I agree with you with regards to Solskjaer. We laugh as journalists because, you know, time to deliver is a kind of stock phrase for us when it comes to signings and also tournaments. But in this case, the depth of the squad at Manchester United is such now that there are no excuses for Solskjaer or indeed for the club with regards to converting performances into tangible winning situations where they are competing for the Premier League title, for the Champions League, for the FA Cup, etc., etc. And questions will rightfully be asked if that's not the case. So it's an upgrade, that's for sure. As I said, even at 36, it's an upgrade.
Look, Solskjaer, you could say he's been handed a problem that needs quite careful management, given the number of players he has in the squad. And there are coaches who would say, I don't want 27 full internationals because it's too difficult to handle that approach. His own words have been throughout this transfer window that he wanted as much depth as possible, so they avoided fitness issues and shortage of players later in the season. So it's his own stated position that he wanted this type of squad where he's got a luxury of options in almost every position. And you know, you can talk about the midfield and needing an upgrade at defensive midfield. They've got a huge number of options and high quality international players in that midfield as well. Donny van de Beek being one of the options that he seems to refuse to use at the defensive midfield. Now we'll see.
I can stick Phil Jones in there, Duncan.
And now we'll see if he could use Victor Lindelof there, who has played in as a defensive midfielder at Benfica in the past. So that's one thing that could be an experiment, given that Varane is going to play alongside Maguire as a first choice throughout the season. But now we'll see if that man management that he which is considered to be one of his strongest traits. I mean, he himself talks about him not being a great coach, and he prefers to delegate that side of duties to other people, and his job is a manager of individuals and a manager of the team. We'll see how good his man management is if he can solve that problem of the bigger squad that he asked his employers to provide him with, and which they've provided him with at very substantial expense in a window where most clubs, there are a few exceptions and quite a few of them are in the Premier League, but where most clubs have had to cut their budgets and be careful in their expenditure. He's been handed a great advantage in terms of the amount of money that's been invested in that team relative to the opposition. And as you say, it's time to see if he can deliver a return on it.
You're right, Duncan, about the expenditure of certain clubs and the lack of expenditure in others. I've got an interesting question for you, though. What do Arsenal and Shirley Bassey have in common?
That they're not performing anymore.
Very good. No, her most famous song was Hey Big Spender, which is exactly what Arsenal have been in this transfer window, having spent in excess of £150 million, £100 million of that on defence alone, which no one can argue, I don't think, having watched Arsenal over the last 18 months, they needed to certainly improve. Weird though, Duncan, that they've lost their best defender, who was Hector Bellerin, to Real Betis of all clubs, which just seems a strange one, but you know, we'll come to that.
Not strange if you're a regular listener to the transfer window, as we pointed out, Bellerin wanted out.
Yeah, no, I meant the club, not the fact that he's left. It's just that I think we would have expected him with his talent to go somewhere other than Seville. However, yes, but they have spent £50 million on Ben White. Obviously, they've also bought other defenders, including Aaron Ramsdale, who you're a big fan of, Duncan, I know, as backup, a £30 million goalkeeper backup to Bert Leno. In terms of the way in which they have gone about their business, it's my information, Duncan, that Mikel Arteta has not had a huge amount of influence with regards to the choosing and the decision making on players that have been recruited. Instead, that responsibility has come down to sporting director Edu and Richard Garlick as well, and that they are taking a policy, which to be fair is fairly common in elite clubs, but certainly in Europe, of recruiting players who they see as being part of the long-term future of the club, playing in a certain style. Data analysis has a major part to play in the choosing, and then the obviously the informing the club of how those players will fit in as well. I'd be slightly concerned if I were Arteta, not just because Arsenal are bottom of the Premier League table, but also given the fact that he's not had the major influence with regards to recruitment as well, which kind of suggests that either he's not trusted or that he is being trusted simply by being given players and saying, you've got to make these guys work because we're paying a lot of money for them, and obviously the salaries as well, etc., etc. But they certainly have been very, very busy in this summer window with regards to their recruitment policy, and so far have not really seen the benefits of that recruitment.
No, look, I'd be more than concerned about the recruitment. I'd be concerned about the way the team is playing and his inability to influence it. They had their worst ever start to the Premier League after two games. They managed to extend that into three games by getting destroyed 5-0 by Manchester City with a player who they decided to retain because they couldn't get the transfer fee they wanted out of Roma for him, Granit Xhaka, and give a new contract to, being sent off early in the game, adding to his quite impressive tally of red cards as a professional footballer, and their tally of red cards since December 2019 was they've received 10 in the Premier League, way ahead of the second worst team in that regard, which is Brighton, and Manchester City and Southampton in 5. And you know, obviously that's partly to do with trying to implement the pressing style that Arteta was party to using at Manchester City and wanted to put in place at Arsenal. But no goals in those three games, no points, 9 goals conceded. The game against Manchester City, just one shot at goal. And you watch Arteta on the touchline at present, and I think the Chelsea game was the one that stood out particularly to me. He's not intervening. There was a simple, as we talked about last week, there was a basic tactical issue that Chelsea were taking advantage of against Arsenal, attacking down the left flank, which won them the game and which Arteta did nothing about. He allowed it to carry on, made no change during that first half, game dead. That's what the coach is paid to do. He's supposed to be the guy who can see what's happening, avoid the situation in the first place, preferably. But if he sees it's going wrong, make the change so you don't get taken out of the game. He doesn't look like a man in control of his own destiny at present. What you say about recruitment is interesting. And look, you can place question marks on several of those deals. Buying Aaron Ramsdale, who was statistically one of the worst goalkeepers in the Premier League during his period there. And I'm not sure from the eye test whether he's that great a goalkeeper either. When you have to find a replacement for Bernd Leno, you need an upgrade. And spending that amount of money on him, principally it seems because he's English and they wanted more homegrown players in their squad, doesn't look like a smart deal. The Ben White one has a lot of pressure on it because he's one of the most expensive English transfers within the Premier League of all time. And a player, very talented, very comfortable on the ball. All the resale value arguments are there. But if you're playing a back four, which Arteta's done most of the time, you're taking a player who excelled in the Premier League in his first season, playing in a back five with two strong physical defenders doing the combative work, and him being the guy who's adding speed and playing the ball from the back once the ball had been won, into a situation where he's now expected to lead a defence that is what has been well off the kind of basics of football in the games they've played at the moment. You don't have to watch much of the analysis on Arsenal to see the defensive errors and the lack of competitiveness in what they're doing, which is costing them these positions in games. They took another defender on deadline day, Takehiro Tomiyasu, who Tottenham had been looking at earlier in the window. People in Japan will tell you that they've got one of the best Japanese national team players there who's physically and technically adapted to the Premier League. Let's hope they're right, because he's going to have a lot of pressure on him coming into that defence and alongside Ben White being expected to solve the problems and build a base from which they can turn themselves into a team that Arsenal are supposed to be in, instead of a team that's been hanging around mid-table and now at the bottom end of the Premier League table.
Still in North London, Duncan. Tottenham Hotspur have been doing a lot of business as well, which is interesting given that they obviously refused to sell Harry Kane to Manchester City for a British record transfer fee for Tottenham. And my information is that Kane's position now is that his representative, who's his brother, Charlie Kane, is hopeful of negotiating an upgrade in Kane's current contract, which would include a release clause, a set release clause, meaning that obviously Kane could leave next summer or indeed in January for a set fee rather than the haggling which went on during the last 3 months between City and Tottenham. With regards to Kane leaving, Kane himself still sees his future as playing in a team that will win trophies, something which he has not experienced. I'm not sure, Duncan, that this is a sustainable situation with regards to where Tottenham are with this. Effectively, Kane has a lengthy amount of time left on his Tottenham contract, and he's effectively asking for a pay rise and a rescission clause without actually giving anything back in terms of a an extension to that contract, which of course would increase his value as time goes on, i.e. if he was to be sold next summer. So it does seem like a little bit kind of one-sided with regards to negotiation, i.e. Advantageous for Kane, but not for the club. And as we know, our friend Daniel Leverage is not one necessarily to give in to such demands with regards to disadvantaging his club.
Yeah, it's you can see one of the arguments that Kane's camp has been putting out, which is Manchester City were prepared to pay well over £100 million to sign our player. The initial bid was that, and they were prepared to go significantly over it, perhaps under 100, up to £150 million. You refuse to sell at that price point blank. That's your decision, regardless of what discussions we may have had in the past and gentlemen's agreements there were about Champions League qualification. But if you value our client at that price, then his pay packet has to reflect that valuation. Therefore, he's entitled to an upgrade. I think that's correct. But if you don't offer anything in return for the upgrade other than performing on the field, I think it's going to be difficult to persuade Daniel Levy, one, to insert a release clause, that one that's likely to be triggered, one that clubs can afford, and two, to raise the wage without putting extra years on the contract. Certainly the inexperience of the people around Kane, I think, has been demonstrated in the window, in that he believed he was going to get to Manchester City. He believed that because City had agreed to sign him and made him first choice and were prepared to go to that transfer fee in the discussions they'd had previously with Levy, that it would be possible to extract himself from the club, and talking publicly about it at a very early stage was done in an unusual fashion, where with no end result and an outcome where he had to back down and publicly state before the end of the window that he was happy to continue at Tottenham and he would give his best for the team. In terms of their other business, yeah, I think you're right. There's a lot of money spent, an interesting deal to take Emerson Royal from Barcelona. Not long after Barcelona had brought him to Camp Nou from, again, an interesting deal they'd set up to bring him from Brazil in the first place. They bought him in tandem with Betis, paid half the transfer fee each and then put him on loan at Betis and recalled him from that loan, paying a fee of €9 million to get him. Tottenham have spent 25 million to sign Emerson as their right back. I think a very good deal to take Pap Sarr from Metz. Player, as we said in earlier podcasts, that a lot of people in Europe think is going to be a top midfielder. So they've secured that transfer. Brian Heal, more questionable, expensive at 25 million, plus Eric Lamella. Christian Romero, again, I think there are doubts about whether they may have overpaid for that one with the 50 million euro deal that's involved in getting him from Atalanta when they exercise the option to buy. What's telling is that they are going for young players. Every one of those outfield players they signed is 23 or younger. They also had an attempt at getting Adama Traore from Wolves, player that Nuno had wanted in. So, you know, pretty radical changes. And also in terms of players, they've moved out with Serge Aurier's contract cancelled at mutual consent. So obviously a payoff going to Aurier from the club to allow him to leave. Toby Alderweireld going to Qatar, money involved in that deal, and certainly a much lower transfer fee than was reported initially on the Alderweireld deal, and Moussa Sissoko moving to Watford.
I'll never understand why Brian Heal's parents didn't call him Achilles. I mean, that's just too good an opportunity to turn down. I mean, imagine, right? Brian or Achilles? There's no competition. It really isn't. It's ridiculous. Before we finish with Hero and Villain Duncan, a quick word on Liverpool, who amongst the elite clubs in the Premier League have been very quiet in this window. We know that their transfer policy is usually very considered and looks very much ahead, and they are quite circumspect with regards to who they recruit. They've gone for extensions to contracts for senior players and spent the money there rather than bringing in talent and players who might improve their squad.
Well, they made one very significant signing in Ibrahima Konate from Leipzig at a substantial transfer fee, and a defender who had a lot of admirers across Europe. So that is an important upgrade. And as you often see with Jurgen Klopp, when he brings new players in, taking his time to introduce them to the training methods and the tactical methods and the style of play before actually putting them in the side. I think Virgil van Dijk's probably about the only one of the major signings. Obviously, Alisson Becker, goalkeeper, so it's a different story. But of the outfield players, van Dijk was the one who went straight into the team and performed. But Kanati's being held back. But you're right. The money has been spent on contract upgrades for Alisson, for Van Dijk, for Andy Robertson, Trent Alexander-Arnold, Fabinho. Don't think you can argue with any of those, particularly the younger fullbacks and Fabinho. The one I think some Liverpool fans are asking questions about is the long new contract that they gave to Jordan Henderson. Until 2025. Henderson is 31 already. He only played 1,706 Premier League minutes last season. Liverpool must be confident that they can get over those injury issues and have sustained performance from the player over at least the next 3 years if they're going to hand out that amount of money to one individual who seems to be on something of a downward trajectory and whose game is definitely a big part of it is his physical presence on the pitch. So I think they'll need to be confident, having done that, that physical presence can be fully reinstated. You saw him in the Chelsea game at the weekend, winding up a lot of the Chelsea players by doing things off the ball. That's a different kind of physical presence to the thing that's needed on the ball, and the pressing that's central to the way Liverpool play.
Let's move on to Hero and Villain on the podcast. Duncan, I'm going to hand over to you for the villain of the last week or so, and tell us who it is and why.
Villain for this week, Mike Dean. The Wolverhampton-Manchester United game, which was interesting in itself, in that Wolves had by far the better of the match, and Manchester United, the first time they start Jadon Sancho and Raphael Varane in the Premier League 11, look very much like the team we've seen them being on many occasions under Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, which is a bit clueless when the opposition set up in a way that takes advantage of them and they don't get an early goal. They end up winning the game, but they end up winning the game because of a Mike Dean error. The challenge from Paul Pogba, where he miscontrols the ball, slides in with his boot off the ground, catches Ruben Neves on the leg, fortunately taking Neves's shin pad rather than his shin. Mike Dean, right in front of it, decides there's no foul. The ball goes to Varane, who sets up Greenwood for one of his superb finishes, and Manchester United come out of the game with a win. I think in tandem, people like Dermot Gallagher, the Premier League employed commentator on Premier League referees, whose argument was, despite various professional footballers telling him that is a completely unacceptable challenge and it should have been a red card for Pogba, never mind a foul. His argument was Mike Dean had the best view of it, therefore we have to go with Mike Dean's view because he was right in front of it and VAR were right not to intervene. Once again, the Premier League ties itself in knots with its application of the system. And as we flagged up on an earlier podcast, this new idea that contact has to be reintroduced into the game, that the English football is better when the players are allowed to kick each other. Now, you can argue that we do need more physicality in the game and it is more entertaining and it's a better visual product. But if we're going to the level where players are allowed to slide in out of control with their studs up onto opponents and the referees ignore it and the VAR ignores it, we're going to end up with some very serious injuries this season.
Strange thing about that one, Duncan, was you can see Neves' shin pad move, but physically move under the force of the tackle. So if Mike Dean didn't see that or VAR didn't see that, I just don't understand how that's not a foul, because there's obvious evidence to the contrary.
It has to be a foul. What reading of the rules is it not a foul to fail to get the ball, to slide in out of control, studs first and hit an opponent? The point of debate is whether Pogba should have had a red card for it, not whether it's a foul. And for VAR not to intervene, as you say, when they have the video evidence of that, it's a joke.
Not a very funny one. My hero of the last few days, I'm going to make it the governor of Govan, or as a former girlfriend of mine called it, Govan. I don't know why. Sir Alex Ferguson, for his part in bringing Cristiano Ronaldo, one of the greatest players of the modern era, back to the Premier League. Long conversations. As Duncan said earlier in the pod, he said, come home, and Cristiano Ronaldo has, and we all look forward to seeing him play back here in the English Premier League. Well done, Fergie. Still got it, son. That's everything for this particular podcast. You can engage with us on our social media channels. We are at Transfer Podcast on Instagram, Twitter, and on Facebook. Duncan, you can find at Duncan Castles on Twitter, and I'm on at GarboSJ on Twitter. Please do engage with us. As you know, we like to be in touch with you and hear your views as well. Until the next time, stay safe, be well, and thanks for listening.